Hello and welcome. This is Your Call. I'm Renee Kemp, sitting in today for Rose Aguilar. You couldn't follow this year's presidential race without hearing about hacking. Hacked emails from Hillary Clinton's staff revealed the inner workings of her campaign, some of it quite embarrassing. The Russian government may have been involved in hacking the Democratic National Committee, causing an upheaval in the DNC that is still reverberating. And these incidents are happening more and more around the world, the hackers always appearing to stay just one step ahead of the security experts. And that means we now have to ask, is this the new normal? And if so, how will political campaigns and governments, ours and others around the world, have to adjust their strategies? And just as importantly, could your vote have been hacked? Joining me today to talk about the hacking of our elections is Kim Zetter. Kim is a senior staff reporter at Wired. She's been covering cybersecurity for more than a decade, and she's also the author of Countdown to Zero Day, Stuxnet, and the launch of the world's first digital weapon. Sounds so ominous. Hi, Kim. Welcome. Thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
We'd like to have our callers join the conversation. I have every reason to believe that people are quite nervous about this. So if you're interested in finding out about the possibility that your vote was hacked on Tuesday, give us a call, 866-798-8255. You can drop us an email at feedback@yourcallradio.org or post a web comment at yourcallradio.org. So, Kim, let's jump right into this. How did we get here? I mean, it feels like a Robert Ludlum novel, only back in the day, people just picked up a phone or eavesdropped from one room to the next with a glass against the wall. So how did we get to this place in 2016?
Well, it has been a progression. We've seen hacking that started two decades ago, that was just for the lulls, you know, the laughs. Hackers who could just get into something to see what they could get into. And then we had a transition into criminal hackers when e-commerce became popular, where the focus was monetary, getting social security numbers and credit card numbers and bank account numbers, things like that. And then we moved into nation-state espionage. China is sort of an expert at this, and Russia and the U.S. But there it was, you know, stealing national security secrets for political advancement, or in some cases, economic advancement in the case of China. And now we're looking at hacking for political influence. And we've seen sort of a couple of cases of this in the corporate world. We saw during the heyday of Anonymous, they hacked into a government contractor, a security company that was a contractor for the government called H.B. Gary, and they released the email spools of the CEO and other employees of that company. And then, of course, we had the Sony hack, where they were going after an attempt to destroy the company. So now it's not that big of a stretch to see the same sort of force targeting political parties, political candidates, governments, and this switch now from just stealing secrets to exposing them sort of opens the door to a lot of different kinds of mayhem.
I was reading an article in Bloomberg News where a hacker says that he's responsible for hacking elections and influencing elections in most of Latin America, Guatemala, Mexico's Enrique Peña Nieto. He says that he's responsible for him having been elected, Colombia, Costa Rica. So in effect, if this man who's quoted in Bloomberg News is right, he's influenced an entire continent. I'm assuming that you're familiar with that article. And is it possible? Is that possible?
Yeah, so that article is a few months old. And he's not in there talking specifically about hacking voting machines. He is talking about influence hacking. And in that case, it's a much more complicated process, and it's very similar to what the CIA used to do, or still does, to influence elections. But in this case, he does get into, you know, voter registration systems, things like that. But it's not about, you know, sort of hacking the voting machines and changing votes themselves. It's about influencing votes. In terms of hacking voting machines, you know, we had experts going sort of one of two ways prior to the election here. I was actually moderating a panel myself in D.C. where the panelists came to the conclusion that you couldn't hack the U.S. election because the machines used across the country are so disparate. Our elections are localized, and every county can choose its own machines. And sometimes, even within a county, there are various machines at polling places. So I think that the thinking there is that because you don't have the same machines across the nation, it would be very difficult to do what's called a remote hack, that is, hack in over the internet to these machines. And that's true for the most part, but you don't have to actually hack the entire country, right? You can choose a few swing states. You can choose very carefully states where you might have problematic voting machines already. So let's take, for instance, Pennsylvania. In 2004, we had a lot of activists around the country who sort of raised the issue of paperless electronic voting machines that a lot of states were purchasing at the time. And because of that that concern that they successfully raised, not just to voting activists but computer security experts, about the problems with verifying an election on paperless machines, a lot of states did pass laws that required their voting machines to have a paper trail. But Pennsylvania is one of those holdout states that in the touchscreen machines that they use there don't have a paper trail. Now, there are some counties there that are using paper ballots, but there are the majority of counties there are using paperless touchscreen machines. So my point here is that you wouldn't have to know or hack into all the different kinds of machines around the country. You could very selectively choose your targets, particularly in swing states that are problematic already.
Well, it just so happens, I think Pennsylvania, there was only a 1% margin. So it might be just enough of a thumb on the scale, yes?
Yeah, I mean, and there are a lot of different things that you can do. So there, after the election, there were, you know, concerns about states where the e-poll books went down. So e-poll books are also this new electronic device that a lot of counties are using. In the past, you'd go into your polling station and they'd have a printout of the voter registration list, right? And you'd give your name and they'd mark down on the piece of paper and you'd sign that piece of paper. Well, some of the same companies that sold these counties electronic voting machines produced electronic poll books so that they don't need this paper printout anymore. The problem with electronic poll books, however, is that they are prone to the same kinds of glitches as any other computer and also prone to errors. So we've had problems in the past where e-poll books were used in large counties, let's say in Georgia, where the e-poll books went down and they didn't have backup paper registration lists, so voters had long lines. And there's also problems, you know, potential of hacking into the voter registration database to remove voters so that when you go to your polling station and they try and pull up your name on an e-poll book, your name is no longer there.
So who's doing this, Kim? I mean, I think it was suggested at one point that it was some overweight guy sitting on his bed in his parents' basement. There are just so many possibilities, from political enemies to other countries to someone with a particular bone to pick, like Anonymous. But just in general, can you identify in situations like this who's doing it?
Well, I want to go back to the issue first of sort of remote hacking, which I talked about. That's you know, unless the machines are connected to the internet, you can't, you know, sort of hack during an election. So what you're going to want to do is do reconnaissance long before the election happens. And in that case, you need really knowledge of the system. So this isn't going to be sort of an overweight hacker in the basement of his mom's house who decides at the last minute that he's going to break into a machine and change the votes. This kind of manipulation requires advanced knowledge and advanced access. And so what you're going at then is two possible kinds of hacks, depending on the machines. If you have election systems in a county headquarters that are connected to the internet that are then used to program those voting machines, program the ballots, or even update source code, things like that. If you can get into that machine and alter the code that goes into the voting machine remotely, then you can do that. And it really depends on the kinds of system, what kind of checks are involved, and if there is remote access to a system that's used actually to program the machines. In many cases, these machines, though, are programmed manually with what's called a PCM CIA card that's inserted into the machine. Now, these machines sit in a warehouse between elections, right?
Mm-hmm.
So you've got large warehouses where thousands of machines are stored, and you also have machines sitting unattended, usually over the weekend before an election occurs. Our elections, national elections, occur on Tuesdays, and many of these machines are delivered to polling places, that is, you know, churches, residential garages, school cafeterias. And they're delivered on Friday, and they're left unattended for the most part, or in a, you know, a simple locked room over the weekend. So if you have access to these machines, you can actually reprogram them using a PCM CIA card. And these machines are not really protected to prevent someone from getting in them. They have what's called tamper evidence seals, but not tamper proof seals. So the seal is supposed to design to indicate if someone has gained access to the machine, but not prevent them. And many of those tamper evidence seals also can be overcome.
Can I just tell you how spooky I think it is when I think about the fact that you're right, those machines were probably sitting in cafeterias and people's basements and libraries and other voting places. It's extraordinary. It's amazing that we haven't seemed to be able to safeguard it any better than that. It just seems so low tech.
Well, yeah, and you know, even more effective than going after, you know, the individual machines, which if you go to, you know, a cafeteria or a church or whatever, you're going to get maybe at the most 10 machines, right? And you're going to have to go through a lot of polling places. But there was an incident that happened in Georgia back in, I forget which year it was, maybe it was 2006. It was an in-between election, I think. Maybe it was the 2008 election. Thousands of Diebold electronic touchscreen voting machines were sitting in a warehouse, and they were being maintained by technicians at Georgia Tech University who were helping the state sort of manage and upgrade the machines. And about 2 weeks before the election, some of those technicians went into this warehouse and upgraded the software in all of these machines. And no one knew what was on that software. It wasn't certified. There wasn't any sort of individual independent oversight of what that software was. So that's the kind of thing that, you know, we're talking about. There are a lot of different ways to get into systems like this. And there are a lot of different ways to change so that you can actually alter a machine so that it only the hack, the malicious part of the hack, only goes into effect under certain conditions, specifically at a certain time of day, or if certain votes are swinging in one direction on the machine, then the malicious software would go into effect. Otherwise, it wouldn't. And it can also erase itself afterwards. So it's hard to do sort of a post-election audit of software to sort of trace if you do think something went wrong.
So do we have any way of knowing whether somehow California voting machines were hacked in the last election, or will we never know?
Well, California, at least in my county, California machines have, we're using optical scan machines. So they have a paper ballot, right?
Mm-hmm.
The paper ballots, I want to emphasize, though, give us a false sense of security. Because unless you actually do a manual audit after an election to check a certain percentage of those paper ballots against the electronic vote, you never really know if the electronic vote matches the paper ballot. And there's something that's called, so a lot of states have mandatory audit laws where they'll take a certain, maybe 1% of randomly selected counties to do that paper against digital audit. But there's a better way of doing this, something that's called a risk assessment audit, or I'm sorry, a risk mitigation audit, which actually is, it varies the percentage of counties you're going to take depending on certain factors, the number of voters, the margin of difference, things like that. And so I think that our counties, our states across the country are not really yet equipped to give us an election in which they can provide us with full integrity.
Of course, the big question is, and why not? I mean, well, why can't we just get this right? And should it be centralized, or does that make the system even more ripe for just widespread nationwide hacking?
Well, by law, our elections are decentralized, and I'm not sure that we want to change that. The problem for why we don't have the security that we need is because there is no sort of overarching system for getting security. So we have election officials around the country who vary in skills. Many of them are very dedicated, obviously, but they don't necessarily have the staffs that they need to figure out the security of their machines or to figure out what they need to do post-audit. I know that a lot of these election officials around the country, they do belong to a national organization, and they share ideas and they share concepts and things that have worked and things that haven't worked. And for some reason, there's just a resistance to, in some cases, accept advice from outside of those groups.
Speaking of which, we have a call from Brent. He's in Half Moon Bay. And he has some insight into the very resistance that you're talking about. Hi, Brent. Thanks for joining us.
Hello. Thank you for having me. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Great. Hello, Kim. How are you?
Fine. Thank you.
Great. Yes, my name is Brent Turner. I'm with California Association of Voting Officials. We've been working on this issue, and as a matter of fact, in San Francisco County, it was recently decided by the Board of Supervisors, the Mayor, and the Election Commission to move toward open source software voting systems to create solution to this problem. New Hampshire has moved in that direction as well, but unfortunately aren't utilizing open source for the tabulation side yet. But to answer your question about the some reason that this hasn't moved forward, in our opinion, and it's been our findings through attempting legislation to correct this security issue, that the Microsoft effect is what we call it. That is the fact that Microsoft is very much against transparent, publicly owned software in the system. So to address your statement that post-election audits provide a semblance of security, that in fact is not correct, as if you receive an inappropriate count from the intellectual property protected software, a bad actor could merely reconcile the post-audit ballot count to match the erroneous first count that comes from the intellectual property protected software. So as the Christine Jennings case shows us out of Florida, when 18,000 votes went missing, when a case is brought forward, the judicial system protects the software. So until we get Microsoft out of the elections and move toward general public license open source, we're going to be encountering the same difficulty in the lack of transparency, which results in the lack of security.
Yeah, so what he's referring to is that a lot of these voting machines, they involve proprietary software that's designed by the voting machine maker, but it runs on top of, in many cases, Windows software. In many cases, Windows XP, which isn't even supported anymore by Microsoft. And so what he's pointing out to is, like, for instance, this isn't the case with necessarily with optical scan machines where, the voter is marking the ballot themselves. But in the case of, for instance, touchscreen machines that produce a paper trail, you can design the user doesn't necessarily in some machines the user is taking the time to view the paper trail and then accepting it. But it is possible when you're doing an audit within the machine and the paper trail that's produced for election officials afterwards to have software that alters the paper trail as well, or that produces, sorry, it produces the paper trail so that the voter sees what they think they need to see. The voter sees the paper trail that they voted for. I'm sorry, sees the candidates they voted for. But internally in the machine, it's still recording something differently. And so that paper trail produces another sort of false sense of security there.
That's correct. And the same is true, actually, with the scanners, because they're running on Microsoft code as well, platforms and vendor-created code. So that has to be open-sourced as well. In essence, if you have any proprietary code near the system, you're down the rabbit hole. And, of course, Silicon Valley's donations to both political parties have created a tremendous logjam in cleaning up this mess. So the president has been briefed on this, along with national security organizations. Unfortunately, I understand his reasons for saying the voting systems were appropriate, but in fact, the scientific conclusion per Secretary of State Deborah Bowen's top-to-bottom report in 2007 is that the systems are inherently insecure and should not be used, and unfortunately we could not get our open-source solutions into play by this election, but we're hoping now with this catastrophe that the California, San Francisco, and the country moves forward toward appropriate solution systems.
All right. Thank you, Brent.
Thank you.
I was just going to comment that, you know, the problem with this, this all began with money. In 2000, the Congress passed the Help America Vote Act, which allocated about $4 billion to states to improve their voting systems, or to upgrade voting systems so that they would be accessible to disabled voters. And that was the reason that we got touchscreen machines, because the voting machine companies touted these as accessible. They could read out the ballot to a blind voter. They could help deaf voters. So that I think that many states felt like they were doing a good thing for voters, right, when they purchased these machines. And they also had really old equipment. We all remember the dangling chads in Florida. So they all thought that they were doing the right thing in purchasing this new equipment, but they didn't have the right advice, and they didn't pay attention. Later, when computer security experts and activists were talking about the danger of these machines. And now we're in a situation where all that money is used up, and even if states wanted to move to more secure machines, they simply don't have the money to do it.
And, you know, the interesting thing is that this election was unique in so many ways. Kim, we're going to talk about the bigger picture going forward. We want to invite callers, 866-798-8255. This election was unique because information was hacked and leaked. And I'm wondering, was your view of your candidate or your political party changed by some of that hacked, leaked information? Do you think those leaks somehow affected the election's outcome? I believe in a conference call, Hillary Clinton said that it was examination of emails that caused perhaps a last-minute shift in the way the campaign ended up going. Give us a call, 866-798-8255. We're going to take a break now and come right back with Kim Zetter. Stay with us.
You're listening to Your Call on KALW Local Public Radio. To take part in today's conversation, call 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-8255, toll free. Let us know if you're a first-time caller. We always like to hear from new voices. And if you prefer to write rather than call, you can email us to feedback@yourcallradio.org. You may leave a comment at their website, yourcallradio.org, or you may tweet us at yourcallradio.
And welcome back to Your Call. I'm Renee Kemp. And joining us today is Kim Zetter. She has been writing for more than a decade about cybersecurity, and that issue is certainly on the front burner given the issues surrounding our last election. She's also the author of Countdown to Zero Day, Stuxnet, and the launch of the world's first digital weapon. And we have several callers who are interested in finding out what mistakes do you think Hillary Clinton and the DNC made, if any, Kim? I mean, were they just careless?
Well, security is hard to get right. You know, in the case of John Podesta, his emails were hacked using a phishing attack, and that is the primary way that most hacks occur, whether they're sophisticated or not sophisticated. It's very hard to sort of defend against a phishing attack that looks like it's an email coming from a legitimate source that you know, and directs you to a malicious link, and so you get malware on your system, and they harvest your password. But there are things that you can do, actually, to protect yourself against a lot of those basic kinds of phishing hacks, and that is you can use two-factor authentication for your email. Two-factor authentication uses your password and something else, like a code that gets sent to your phone or get sent to an app on your phone. Actually, using the app version or token is much more secure than getting a text message to your phone. But that means that someone who gets on your system and obtains your password can't get into your system unless they're on, you know, your computer all the time with you and reading your email.
Interesting, isn't it, that reportedly Donald Trump doesn't use a computer? He's on Twitter, but to what extent do you think that was an advantage, that his team didn't have to do anything to secure his communications?
Well, that's just his communication. His team, of course, are using computers. You can't run a campaign, a modern campaign these days, without computers. In the same way that, you know, President Clinton may not be tweeting himself out of the White House or necessarily using a computer on a daily basis, but all of his team is. And really, that's the soft underbelly, right? It's the campaign workers. It's the low-level people that will get you into a network and then allows a hacker to pivot once they're inside that network to get to the important systems that they want.
And doesn't it seem interesting, too, that how the public views these hacks kind of depends on who they think the targeted victim is? I know Anonymous was celebrated as heroes because they were hacking child pornography sites and they were publicizing the names of KKK members, and a lot of people thought that was swell. But this time someone else's ox is being gored, and it's a different reaction in many cases, yes?
Right. I mean, we're all equal in the eyes of a hacker these days. All you need is something that someone wants. And we all have something to hide, right? If you look at the climate change, academics whose emails were hacked and exposed, you know, if you have a contrary opinion, if you're you don't even need to be a public figure. You know, people get their systems hacked by ex-boyfriends and ex-girlfriends and things like that. So it's a very much an equalizer, sort of our digital lives, right?
Yes, we have an email from Greg. He says, let's see. Actually, let's go to a caller. Let's go to Robert in Richmond, and then we'll come back to the email. Hi, Robert. Let's go to you. You've been holding for a while.
Yeah, hi. I wanted to. I'm really glad you're having this discussion. It's great to examine all the weaknesses in security, and it's going to be. I mean, you might want to point out that the higher and higher you go up the chain, the easier it is to alter the vote count. Eventually you're going to get to like one person that's going to decide what the vote is. Get to that machine or that person, you can change it so easily there rather than changing it in the field, although that can be done if you start early enough. But my comment is about the redshift. I don't know if you heard about this term, but it's the consistent trend of official tallies of the votes to be biased toward the Republicans versus the exit poll counts. And this happened in 2004 with Kerry in Ohio. It happened this election where the Edison Research Company did exit polls. They found 23 out of 28 exit polls showed a redshift toward Trump. And this is evidence for fraud. And it's not just 2016, 2004. It also happened in 2012 and 2000, and there's a mathematician named Charnin who's looked at 300 of these cases of exit polls, different from the official tallies, and he's found that in 167 cases, the bias was towards the red. And the chances of that happening, just by chance, are in the one over trillions, more than trillions. It's such an obvious evidence of tampering. And I don't know why Democrats who believe in the science of global warming don't believe in the science of statistics when it comes to proving election fraud. So that's one part of my statement question. Maybe you should publicize that more. The other suggestion I have for unhackable or less hackable audit trails is the creation of an audit trail where every voting machine takes a picture of every ballot. So that at the end of it, you have this trail. You've got this picture of every paper ballot that then is published in the cloud, so that anybody can get into that paper trail, a digital paper trail, and count the votes themselves. And each ballot would be distinguished from every other ballot by the squiggles of the pencil. It's like a human signature. So that you can detect duplications that way, and you can detect dropouts by comparing the total number of votes. Total number of images with the total number of votes that were supposed to be cast, and it's a great way to audit. And it's and the data storage is cheap. It's like less than an hour long movie for any voting machine. It's a terabyte or two per machine. It's cheap. It's very easy to do. So anyway, those are my comments. And what do you think,
Kim?
Well, I'm not a polling expert, so I can't really speak to the issue of the bias, the red bias, and all of that. We get this with every election, though, right? It all depends on how much faith we have in the polls, and if we have faith in the polls and the polls turn out to be right, then it increases our faith in the polls. And if the polls happen to be wrong one year, then suddenly we're saying it's evidence of fraud. So I don't know enough about polling, to be able to speak with that with authority on that. With regard to the sort of the validation of an election, what he's describing is something that was promulgated by a cryptographer named David Chom back in 2008, I think it was. He had put together this theory of what he thought would be a way to be able to verify elections, and that is that all of the ballots that get counted, that as a voter you get what's called a hash of your vote when you cast your ballot on a machine, and that hash means that nothing, that hash is a cryptographic representation of the data in your ballot. And if anything on that ballot changes, your hash, the hash that you get as the voter would be different from the hash of the ballot that gets posted. And so his idea was that you would then post these ballots online and people would be able to verify that that your vote got counted. You'd be able to find, the hash that matches your vote. And it didn't matter that most voters wouldn't actually go to the trouble of checking it. He determined that you would only need a certain number of voters that would actually do that. That would be a sufficient check of the validity of the election. But I think that most people think that that's a really complicated process and hard to implement, and it hasn't really been taken seriously as a viable solution.
For those of you just joining us, I'm Renee Kemp sitting in for Rose Aguilar. This is Your Call. We're podcasting the show. You can find more information on yourcallradio.org. And briefly, coming up tomorrow, we'll be looking at the struggle to keep the U.S. Postal Service healthy. Is it ripe to be privatized? There are reports in the Bay Area that people aren't getting their mail at all. If they do, sometimes it's 1 or 2 o'clock in the morning. What is going on with the U.S. Postal Service? Can it maintain its levels of service, or is it ripe to be privatized? It's an interesting conversation, especially this time of the year when we have holiday mail, so we hope you'll join us. And if you have some questions for Kim Zetter, give us a call at 866-798-8255. We're talking today about the hacking of elections. And Kim, again, this is nothing new. It goes back, for as long as there's been elections and spies. But it's interesting that I now understand that a lot of folks in D.C. they know better than to rely on their email anymore. They meet in person at a local coffee shop or in a park. They just know that this can't be secured. It can't be relied on. And is that the way it has to go going forward, that you just have to do in-person meetings? There is no way to actually secure any internet communication.
Well, I mean, election officials or even bureaucrats in D.C. Have always known that their email is sensitive because, you know, we as reporters and others can FOIA documents and communications. However, they had a little bit of control there, right? Mm-hmm. So the FOIA officer would come to them and say, do you have any communication that is responsive to this FOIA request on this subject? And they would argue for why it should be redacted. And of course, if anyone has ever filed a FOIA, you know that about 98% of the data, the contents of anything you get from the government is redacted. But you know, there was that awareness always that email is sensitive, and many conversations never happen in email; they happen in person for that reason. But yeah, this takes it even to another level because you know, many of these conversations, they don't necessarily, they're not talking about classified information, right? And they can still be sensitive. Simply the strategizing that you do, simply the criticism that you give of an opponent or of a donor or something like that. All of that information that you, in the past, wouldn't have even considered twice as sensitive now needs to be considered as sensitive.
Let's go to Deborah. She's had issues when she was registering to vote. Hi, Deborah. Thanks for waiting.
Hi. It actually wasn't about registering to vote. I was already registered to vote, and I, in fact, vote by mail. It was several issues from the Department of Elections in San Francisco related to, first, they had someone who had never lived at my address registering to vote, and when I called to tell them that they had someone whose paperwork was coming to this address, they said, oh, we think it must have been a clerical error, and they checked it and found out, no, in fact, somebody had registered to vote at my address and did not live here. So then I had done my vote by mail, and then they contacted me and said that my signature didn't match, and I don't change my signature around, so I got a notice, went into the Department of Elections, and they said, oh, yes, that's your signature. Then they duplicated the vote by mail ballot and sent me an additional vote by mail ballot. And so I called them up and I said, you know, hey, this is probably expensive for you guys to send me a duplicate ballot. And they said, oh, well, we'll send you a form, which they never did. So my concern is that forget about hacking the machines. How about hacking the city? And how about hacking the Department of Elections? I mean, I don't know about the security itself of, you know, municipal Department of Elections. Couldn't things be changed on the Department of Elections information website?
It's a good question, Kim, because in effect, what this does is cause us to question all of the agencies and systems.
Yeah, so and this was something that one of the callers was talking about in terms of the higher up you go, the more effect you can actually have on the election. So let's say you don't bother with the machines themselves, but you hack the vote tally machines. We have a canvassing process post-election where election officials do, you know, sort of the comparison. They compare that the number of voters who actually showed up at the polls or sent in a ballot matches the number of ballots that they actually have. They do other kinds of checks. But the thing is that if you can alter the results on an election night, we're a country that demands instant results, right? We want to know within a few hours after the polls close who won. And we don't really pay attention afterwards during the canvassing process if something shows up as an irregularity, right? Because we've already sort of dedicated to that winning candidate or those results a lot of resources, and it's really hard to sort of go back on that. So it would have to be something caught in the aftermath that would be really egregious and outside of sort of the accepted margin of error. This whole process is not perfect, and you know, it's it's never really questioned when you have results that everyone accepts, right? When you have an election that's not as contentious as this one, when you have one candidate that's extremely more popular or more anticipated as the winner, all of those elections that we have, we don't really pay attention to them. We only pay attention to all these little issues when it comes down to either a result that we don't like or a result that is too close for comfort. And that's what we have in this year.
And, you know, I don't know why people's hair isn't on fire about the whole Russian aspect of this. CNN is reporting this morning that federal investigators believe Russian hackers were behind cyber attacks on a contractor for Florida's election system that may have exposed the personal data of Florida voters. Why
yeah, that
isn't
wasn't
our
the election
hair on
system.
Fire?
So that was the voter registration system, so it's not connected to the voting machines or the election system itself. I don't know in that case if it's on the same computer where they program the voting machines or what. But in that case, it was a contractor that created the proprietary software for the voter registration database. And in that case, you know, that it's always a possibility, again, that someone can get into those registration databases and erase the names of people. And so, these things that happen in a short time span, you know, either in early voting or on election day, our elections are very compact and they're over in a matter of, I mean, this was really a long election season in terms of the parties, but the actual election process is very short and in many states still only election day. And so things, again, that you might look at after the election never really happen. We get our results and we move on. And we don't really sort of examine post-election really the whole process of everything that went wrong.
You know, I'm interested, too, in whether we might, as a, you know, the American intelligence and spy community didn't start the spiral with Stuxnet. You remember, I mean, callers and listeners might remember Stuxnet was deployed in order to disrupt an Iranian nuclear facility, and it did so successfully. And your book deals with that countdown to zero day Stuxnet and the launch of the world's first digital weapon. So tell us about the book and what it portends.
Well, so the book Stuxnet was exemplary in the sense that it was the first virus worm that didn't just take over the machine that it infected. Stuxnet was designed to sort of leap from that machine into the physical world and cause physical destruction of equipment that those machines were controlling. And that was the first time we'd ever seen that. And so that portends for a lot of different systems that are operating critical infrastructure, like the uranium enrichment program in Iran. Many of our systems are our electric grid, the water systems, water treatment plants, chemical plants, even our traffic lights, elevators, heating and cooling systems. All of this critical infrastructure is run on the same kinds of systems that operated that plant in Iran, and they are not secure in the same way our voting machines are not secure. And many of them are connected over the internet, and so you can get into these systems and manipulate them. We had another recent case in Ukraine last December where three power distribution plants, hackers got into those plants and turned off the power for about 250,000 customers in the middle of December, right? This is a week before Christmas, or a couple of days before Christmas. It was out for only about 6 hours, but they did it in such a way that the technicians couldn't remotely turn the power back on for those customers from the control stations. They actually had to send technicians out into the field in order to reconnect the breakers. And that was just a kind of hack that's basically just sort of what we call a proof of concept. It was meant to show Ukraine what's possible. The hackers in that case could have done much worse damage if they'd wanted to.
Well, if the U.S. intelligence community is correct, and this last election had elements of Russian hacking, the administration now is promising what they're calling a proportional response. So what does that look like? Does it go as far as a Stuxnet-type response?
Yeah, I mean, we don't know. There were hints that, you know, Putin has his own secrets to hide. So it suggested that maybe we would see a counter email dump, right? I think that when you start to get into that kind of tit for tat, though, in the cyber realm, you're really opening yourself up to a kind of unlimited attacks and sabotage then. And I think that any country that starts to engage in this is going to be in trouble. I don't think that you can fully anticipate the consequences of the escalation of what can happen when you start to sort of hack back. Now, they didn't say that would be the nature of their response. It's really unclear. In the case of North Korea, when the government attributed that to the Sony hack to North Korea, they didn't necessarily hack back to North Korea. They applied sanctions. Same case with the Chinese hackers who were doing espionage, economic espionage here in the U.S. In that case, the U.S. indicted some military officials in China. So there are all different kinds of methods that you can do in response, and they don't necessarily have to be hacking back, and that may not be the most effective.
Because certainly once an escalation begins, it could be very dangerous, because what I hear you saying is that everything from the electric grid to our personal emails are vulnerable. There's just no way to guarantee that they are hack-proof.
Right, and when you're talking about the infrastructure here, in the old military days, in old warfare days, everything, you could separate sort of military from civilian. Although, cities obviously got bombed, and infrastructure got bombed. But you had sort of separate communication systems for the military, and you could take those out. But now everything is interconnected. The government and the military are all on the same ISPs that we're on. They're all on the same backbone. They're all on the same infrastructure. And we saw that sort of awareness with in the Middle East, when the allies, the U.S. and its allies, were looking at going into Libya. And there was a plan that was proffered to sort of take out the communication structure of the Libyan military and government. And then ultimately someone determined that it was too interconnected, that you would have consequences of taking down hospital communications and others sort of. So I think that, this kind of it's something that I point out in the book. It's that these digital weapons, when you're operating in the civilian realm, and in our infrastructure realm, they're uncontrollable. You can't necessarily control exactly what they're going to do and where they're going to go.
Yeah, back in October, Naomi Klein, the writer, did an interview with The Intercept magazine, and she says that there are just basic serious threats to personal privacy and political systems posed by this very sort of hack, because indiscriminate publication of someone's personal emails is a clear and present threat. Yes?
It is. I mean, the NSA and the government and the DOD, they go to great lengths to protect government communications. But many of those systems, I mean, if it's not, remotely hacking, then there's also the danger of an insider, right? Someone like Edward Snowden, or this latest NSA worker who's been arrested, possibly in relation to the Shadow Broker leak, which was the dumping online of hacking tools that the U.S. government uses. So I think that, the digitalization of everything, of our national security secrets, of our tools, all of that now is open to exposure in a way that we haven't been in the past.
Well, I'm wondering, too, if we just get inured to this sort of thing, when it becomes par for the course that you're going to get malware or some kind of ransomware, or that you're going to get hacked. Are we just at some point just going to stop paying attention and just get numb to the idea of these leaked emails?
Well, I think we already are to a certain extent. I mean, until something like the Sony hack happened, you know, hacking has been going on for more than a decade. And, you know, people didn't care if their credit card got hacked because it was a minor inconvenience, right? The bank, you had zero liability. You had a little inconvenience of having to get a new card issued. It cost the banks money to reissue those cards. But then they would pass those costs back to you anyway. So even though you felt like you had zero liability, you were ultimately paying for those hacks. But most people didn't really care, right? And even the espionage, the government espionage that China is doing, it seems silent, right? And it's in the background, and we don't really have a direct consequence to ourselves. The Sony hack started getting into the more personal realm, and also the Ashley Madison hack. You know, a lot of people felt like Ashley Madison was protecting their secrets, right? And then they discovered that, no, that's not the case. They can't really protect it. So I think that these kinds of hacks are starting to hit home more. And the Sony hack was a huge wake-up call for corporate America. And also the Panama Papers, the Panama leaks, and that the Panamanian law firm. And all of the documents that got leaked there, and the, you know, the Icelandic politician who lost his job. So I think that it is a new world order, and I think that it's only going to get worse.
Because they certainly seem to be staying a good step ahead of the security experts who are always on their tail.
It is harder to keep hackers out than it is for hackers to get in.
All right, Kim Zetter. Interesting conversation, although I must say I kind of got a chill and the hair on the back of my neck stood up because it just doesn't appear that there is any real defense. But hopefully people will take steps to secure their own personal information. Kim Zetter is the author of Countdown to Zero Day, Stuxnet, and the launch of the world's first digital weapon. Thank all of you for joining us. I'm sorry we couldn't get to all of your calls and emails. We hope you'll join us again tomorrow. I'm Renee Kemp, sitting in for Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. On the next Your Call, the United States has some of the fastest, most efficient mail delivery in the world. But there are reports that Bay Area residents haven't been getting their mail. If they do, sometimes they get it as late as 2 or 3 in the morning. Mail carriers certainly have challenges, and the Postal Service is struggling. Can the Postal Service maintain its renowned levels of service? And is the Postal Service ripe for privatization? Join us on the next Your Call with me, Renee Kemp, and you.
Your Call comes from the listeners of KALW. To listen to past shows or sign up for our podcast, visit yourcallradio.org. Laura Flynn produces the show, Malihe Razazan is senior producer, Matt Martin is executive producer, and Helena Murphy is our intern and researcher. Phil Hartman is our chief engineer, and Kevin Vance is our studio engineer. Our theme music is performed and composed by Live Human. You can email us at feedback@yourcallradio.org.